Before I start, I think we just need to take a moment and say hooray for books. I mean, we love books, right? I have one of my earliest memories as a child, and one of my happiest memories was every Friday afternoon, my mom would take us to a bookstore and we would buy books. And then one of my favorite books is A Wrinkle in Time, who many of you probably know that book, and my mom reading that book to me at night. So I want to just acknowledge why we're here today and just how much we love books and how grateful we are for them, because they make our lives so much richer. Six times higher, 20 times greater. That's what the theory of disruption indicates will happen when you pursue a disruptive course. Your odds of success will be six times higher. Your revenue opportunity, 20 times greater for your company and for you. You don't need to cope with the force of disruption. You can harness its power and its unpredictability to propel you forward. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning. I want to tell you a story. In 2005, I was working as an equity analyst at Merrill Lynch, and it was my job to issue buy and sell recommendations on stocks like América Móvil, the fourth largest cellular company in the world. One day I said to a friend, I'm going to quit my job. Whitney, have you lost your mind? I knew it was the right thing to do, but it was completely illogical because I was at the top of my game. I'd just come back from Mexico. As I sat in the audience with hundreds of other people, I listened to Carlos Slim, the controlling shareholder of América Móvil, one of the world's richest people. He trades places, he ping-pongs with Bill Gates. As I sat in the audience, he was quoting my research. He was referring to me as La Whitney. I had institutions like Fidelity asking me for my financial models, and when I would upgrade or downgrade a stock, it would typically move several percentage points. Not only was I at the top of my game, but getting this place of power and respect was hard won. 15 years earlier, I had arrived in New York with my husband so he could pursue his PhD in microbiology. As we drove across the George Washington Bridge into Manhattan, I was terrified. I would never have gone to New York on my own. There were so many people, such tall buildings, horror stories, crime, drugs. For the first week, I wouldn't go anywhere by myself. But we had to put food on the table, so eventually I had to go out of our 17th floor student housing apartment and get a job. I majored in music, so the obvious choice, as you saw, was Wall Street. But because I had never set foot in a single business course in college, I had no connections and clearly very little confidence, I started as a secretary working for a retail broker at Smith Barney in Midtown Manhattan. It was an exciting time to be on Wall Street. It was 1989, the era of liar's poker, of bonfire of the vanities, of working girl. And swept up, I didn't want a job. I wanted to work on Wall Street. So I started taking business courses at night. I had a boss who believed in me, which allowed me to move up from secretary to investment banker. And if you've worked on Wall Street, you know that rarely happens. Then a step back to become an equity analyst, and eventually I co-founded an investment firm with Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School. I would not have known to call it this then, but when I walked onto Wall Street through the secretarial side door, and when I walked off of Wall Street to become an entrepreneur, I was a disruptor. Disruptive innovation, it's a term coined by Clay Christensen to describe a low-end or new market innovation that eventually upends an industry, like Toyota did to GM, Target did to Sears, and now we see Uber doing to the yellow caps. In my case, I'd started at the bottom, climbed to the top, and now I wanted to upend my career. According to the theory, a disruptor secures a foothold at the low end of the market. Think Amazon in the 90s. Initially, its position is weak. Barnes and Noble and Borders could have crushed them like a cockroach, but they didn't. Market leaders rarely bother. It's just this silly little product. Let's go after bigger, faster, better. The problem is that once a disruptor gains a foothold, it too is motivated by bigger, faster, better. And by the time a counterattack does make sense, say it with me, it's too late. To be fair, these low-end disruptors, they're easy to miss. In 2002, I started to build my model on América Móvil. And one of the key inputs to this model was wireless penetration. Based on the, well, actually, I'm not good to the demographics yet. Let me tell you where we were. So at this point in time, it's 2002, wireline penetration is 15%. Wireless penetration is 25%, up from 1% 5 years earlier. So now looking at how many people could afford a phone, how many people had access to credit, I thought maybe penetration can increase from 25 to 40%. Enter Carlos Slim. He saw the 40% or 40 million people I saw, but he saw a much bigger opportunity. He saw another 50% or 50 million people who wanted to be connected but couldn't afford to. So what does Carlos Slim do? He offers them subsidized handsets and prepaid phone cards, making affordability and credit non-issues. And sure, the sound quality is bad for this silly little product, but bad sounds better than no sound. Today, wireline penetration has increased from 15% to 20%. Wireless is up from 25%, not to 40%, but to, did you do your math? 90%. One of the reasons that disruption is so hard to spot is because of the timing. Growth can be flat for years and then suddenly spike upward. Wireless was introduced in Mexico in 1988, and for almost a decade, penetration was less than 1%. And then from 1997 to 2002, whoop, to 25%. When an industry is in upheaval, booyah, say the 50% or 50 million people who are now connected. But for the individual experiencing a seismic shift in what the world looks like, it can be pretty unsettling. Each of us has a view of the world that is powered by personal algorithms. We look at all the components of our personal social system and how they interact, and then we come up with patterns to predict what will happen next. When systems behave linearly and react immediately, we're fairly accurate with our forecast. You flip a switch and boom, the light goes on. But when they don't, our predictive power plummets. One of the best ways to make sense of this non-linear world is the S-curve. Just as the S-curve helps us gauge how quickly an innovation will be adopted, the S-curve helps us deal with these time delays, providing milestones that we can watch for. At the outset, you see that growth will be slow. I'm going to see if this works. Okay, once a tipping point is reached, which is 10 to 15%, you enter hypergrowth, and at 90% or saturation, growth tapers off. Facebook, for example. Assuming a market opportunity of 1 billion people, which it's now exceeded, it took Facebook roughly 4 years to reach penetration of 10%. But then once it reached this critical mass of 100 million users, over the next 4 years, because it had entered hypergrowth, it added not 100 million, but 800 million users. Now, we could quibble over whether or not it has reached saturation. But there's no question that the rate of growth has begun to slow. What I find fascinating and encouraging about the S-curve is it also helps us understand the psychology of disruption. If you, for example, just started a new job, the S-curve tells you that initially your progress is going to be slow. It's going to seem like it's non-existent. This helps you avoid discouragement. Then as you put in the hours and hours and hours of practice, you're going to accelerate into competence and then confidence. As you approach mastery, you're going to be able to do your job very, very easily, but because you're no longer enjoying the feel-good effects of learning, boredom and complacency can kick in. If at this point you don't jump to a new curve, your plateau can become a precipice. There are volumes of research indicating that the odds of success improve for products and services and companies and countries, but the fundamental unit of disruption is the individual. The best way to drive corporate innovation is through personal disruption. If you can ride the waves of learning and mastering, you will have a competitive advantage in this era of accelerating disruption. And whether an organization or an individual, I've identified 7 variables that will help you as you move along this curve. Number 1, take the right risks. There are 2 kinds of risks I want to talk about this morning. The first is competitive risk, the second is market risk. If a colleague comes to you and says, there's a huge market opportunity out there and I have got the projections to prove it, it's likely that someone's already scoped out the market, there's a kingpin, and it ain't you. So you have to figure out if you can compete and win. This is competitive risk. If a colleague instead comes to you and says, I don't know if there's a market, I really don't, but I think there's a need that's not being met. You don't know if there are customers, but there's no competition either. So as a first mover, if there are customers, you're favored to own the market. That's market risk. So how does this apply to individuals? Well, 20 years ago, I had just had my son, the 19-year-old son, and I was hired into equity research to cover the cement and construction sector. And believe it or not, I was really excited. So I'd started to build my financial model, and then Smith Barney announces it's going to merge with Salomon Brothers, and guess what? They already have a highly ranked cement and construction analyst. Cement shoes? However, there were a number of media companies going public, no analyst to cover them. As the theory of disruption would dictate, rather than knocking on a cement door that was closed, I built my own media door, and within a year, I too was a ranked analyst. But here's the rub. Competitive risk feels less risky because it's more certain. But if you can deal with the uncertainty of market risk, you're more likely to be successful. And then you walk through the door of market opportunity by playing to your distinctive strengths. And that's number 2, a distinctive strength being something that you do well that other people within your sphere do not, like a fish out of water. Janie Juvan is a partner at a law firm in Cleveland, and she's a great example of this. So as a second-year associate, her mother got sick with cancer. This is a decade ago. Mother gets sick, and she's trying to figure out what happened, so she goes online and discovers this huge support group. At the same time, she's a second-year associate, so she has this requirement to network. She can't go out because she's with her mom, so she says, why don't I network online? She starts on Twitter. The partners look at her and go, what are you doing? I mean, we all know that law firms tend to be pretty conservative, and why would she play where no one is playing anyway? Again, this is 10 years ago. But she persisted. And in 2008, when the economic downturn came, Because she'd landed clients via social media, she was able to sidestep layoffs. And then, when she was up for partner, make a very compelling case. Now, again, this is after the fact, this social media fish swimming in legal waters. The trouble for most of us is figuring out what our strengths are in the first place. So I want to give you a few clues. The first is, what makes you feel strong? Marcus Buckingham says that our strengths clamor for our attention in the most basic way. Using them makes you feel invigorated, inquisitive, successful. Second one is, what exasperates you? The frustration of genius is in believing that if it's easy for you, it must be easy for everyone else. Your colleagues may not be incompetent. It may just be that you're prodigy-like in this one area. You don't know how to tell people how to do what you want done because you don't know how you know. So the next time you find yourself frustrated, exasperated, consider the possibility that you are bumping up against your genius. What do other people say you do well? What compliments do you dismiss? If to a particular compliment you say, oh, it was nothing, because for you it was nothing, it's as natural as breathing. Or you say, oh, that compliment again, why can't they compliment me on this other thing that I worked really, really, really hard to learn? People tend to undervalue what they are, overvalue what they're not. If you want to know what your strengths are, consider those compliments that you dismiss. In fact, it's quite likely that your superpowers are not on your resume because you overlooked or ignored them. If you want to fly up the S-curve, bring your superpowers out to play, ideally where no one else is playing. Number three, embrace constraints. Whenever you're trying something new, upending the status quo, you want and need lots of feedback. One of the best ways to get that feedback is to impose constraints. Think about skateboarders. They're some of the quickest learners in the world because they receive incredibly fast and useful feedback. Every action, every move has an immediate consequence. And did you know that some of the most famous scenes in Jaws came about because the mechanical shark that Steven Spielberg wanted to use, it didn't work. So he's over budget, behind schedule, he finally shoots the scenes from the shark's point of view and lets the music and our imagination do the rest. 2007, Entrepreneur Magazine put together this list of the 500 fastest growing companies in the United States. What was unusual about this particular list is that they looked at how these entrepreneurs had funded their growth. Found some really interesting things. Only 28% had had access to bank loans or lines of credit. Only 14% had access to equity. And only 4% had access to venture capital. What this means is that at least 50%, as much as 72% of these companies had bootstrapped their businesses, built them with the cash and the resources that they had on hand. And 61% were profitable within the first year. So I ask you, was Steven Spielberg, were these entrepreneurs successful in spite of or because of their constraints? In 1954, an editor at Houghton Mifflin read the now famous article, Why Johnny Can't Read. Concerned, he reached out to an editor friend of his and he said, I need you to take 225 unique words every six-year-old knows and write me a story they can't put down. Took him a year and a half. At one point, he was so discouraged, he almost gave up. But in 1957, when Theodore Geisel published The Cat in the Hat, it was an instant hit. Years of reciting rhymes, of creating cartoons, of leveraging what he did uniquely well, prepared Geisel to reinvent children's literature when presented with a 225-word constraint. For disruptors, constraints aren't a check on absolute freedom. They're a tool of creation. Number four, battle entitlement. This is the belief that I exist, therefore I'm entitled. Sadly, I see it in myself all the time. It is not just millennials. It comes in many, many guises, like cultural entitlement. We all need to feel that we belong. A sense of belonging gives us the confidence that we need to climb that curve. But as we begin to see the fruits of taking the right risks, of playing to our strengths, it's easy to start to believe that this is the way things should and will always be. When my husband was doing graduate work in microbiology, he would grow cells in this beautiful pink-colored media. And after several days, the cells would use up the nutrients and he would need to, well, they would produce byproducts, some of which were toxic, so he'd have to replate them and put them into a new petri dish. We may like our current petri dish. We may even feel that we belong, that this feels really, really good. But if we want to avoid stagnation and even toxicity that pushes us back down the curve, we'll occasionally need to transplant ourselves to new cultures. A practical and effective way of doing this is to open up your network. Sure, a closed network reinforces your sense of belonging, but you're going to hear the same ideas over and over and over again. An open network can be kind of painful because you're going to be around people who don't agree with you necessarily or who know more than you do, but you're more likely to have breakthrough ideas. Here's what the science says. A group of researchers out of Northwestern analyzed 18 million academic articles written over the course of a decade. It classified them into high-impact and low-impact papers. The high-impact papers being papers that people read and they talked about, low-impact, not so much. For the low-impact papers, 100% of their sources were highly conventional, people and ideas from inside of their network. For the high-impact papers, 85 to 95% were the usual suspects, but 5 to 15% were highly novel, people and ideas from outside of their network. When these academics were willing to transplant themselves academically, intellectually, they were 2 times more likely to write a high-impact paper. If you want to move into hypergrowth, up your learning curve, and stay in hypergrowth, you'll battle entitlement, which sometimes may mean that you've got to step back in order to grow. When organizations get too big, they often stop exploring smaller opportunities because the revenue just isn't big enough. Just as Barnes & Noble and Borders neglected e-commerce, people can stall at the top of their learning curve. The way to avoid this is to jump to a new curve. Doesn't necessarily mean you need to change companies or jobs. In fact, in the best companies, you won't need to. Dave Blakely, he started his career as an engineer at IDEO. He could have worked his way up to manage technical staff, but early on, he volunteered to become a project manager. Which, by the way, if you're an engineer, you know that many of his peers dismissed this as an escape route from the rigor and detail of engineering. But the backward move allowed Blakely to begin to climb a new ladder. And after his 25-year tenure at IDEO was complete, he was the head of all of technology strategy. As you look to tilt the odds in your favor, beware the undertow of the status quo. You may like you right where you are. Your stakeholders may like you right where you are. But there really is no such thing as standing still. And sometimes sideways turns into a slingshot. Sometimes, too, there's failure. Whenever you try something new, there's this fantasy of a simple, linear, up one, over one rule. But sometimes things don't work. My moments of humiliation include bombing a speech in front of hundreds of people, being fired, and backing a business that imploded. When I fail, no matter how many chirpy quotes I tweet, I am despondent and pessimistic, and I want to move to another city because I can never show my face in public ever again. Marjorie Howell said, "There is dignity in suffering, nobility in pain, but failure is a salted wound that burns and burns and burns again." Brené Brown said, "Failure is especially acute for corporate professionals. When the ethos is kill or be killed, control or be controlled, failure is being killed, and it elicits tremendous shame." That speech I bombed, by the time I was finished, I had beads of sweat dripping down my face. I looked like I had just run 3 miles. When I was fired, I was so devastated, I thought I would never recover emotionally. And the business that I backed, how could I claim to be a savvy investor? When I fail, I'm not only embarrassed, but I'm heartbroken. Because I had envisioned a future in which I would achieve a goal, perhaps even be hailed the conquering hero, and then I didn't, and I wasn't. It's important to grieve. And then we have to ditch the shame. Because when you buy into the shame, you allow it to become a referendum on you, and you forfeit the ability to ask the question, what important truth did I learn because of this failure? I think one of the most important things I've learned is that whether I see an experience or as a failure or a success, it's a choice. About a year and a half ago, I was giving a speech to about 2,500 people. The gist of the speech was different than it is today. It was to place as much emphasis on feminine characteristics like relationships as we do on masculine characteristics, the power and achieving. It's based on Jungian psychology. So speech is off to this great start until about 20 seconds in when I completely forget what I'm going to say. I went blank. So I'm walking across the stage, just a minute, I really can't fake it, just a minute, when a woman sitting right over there, to this day I don't know who she was, hollered out, "You can do it, Whitney." And with that, my memory came back. A few hours later, my agent texted me and said, "So, how did it go?" Well, how did it go? Because according to the metric of power and achieving, it was a failure. I had forgotten what I was going to say on stage in front of 2,500 people. But according to the metric of connection, it was one of the best speeches I'd ever given. So now I had to make a choice. Was it the best or the worst? It was tough. I mean, you don't work on Wall Street without valuing power and achieving. But ultimately, I chose best. Paraphrasing John Milton, the mind is its own place and can make of every heaven a hell, of every hell a heaven. The mind is its own place and can make of every success a failure, of every failure a success. As you move through your learning curve, what will you make of your experiences? Number 7. Be driven by discovery. As a disruptor, you are in search of this yet-to-be-defined market. You're looking for market opportunity. You don't know what it's going to be like, so you have to do this emergent strategy. Rather than performing a detailed market analysis, developing a step-by-step plan to achieve your goal, you take a step forward, you gather feedback, and you adapt accordingly. This probably means you will end up in a place you hadn't anticipated, and you won't be alone. 70% of all successful new businesses end up in a different place too. Did you know that Groupon started out as an activism platform, bringing people together to fundraise for a cause and to boycott retailers, which I find ironic? Netflix started out as a door-to-door DVD rental service. We all like to make plans for the future, but pursuing a disruptive course requires that you can't see the top of the curve from the bottom. And sometimes you can't see the bottom from the top. It also means you need to get the metrics right. If you think about it, metrics are a de facto form of constraint because they give you lots of information. There's a myriad of metrics you can use to measure your progress. Think Moneyball. But the most important metric that you can use is how many times do you show up? The odds of a scientist writing a groundbreaking research paper are directly correlated not to how smart the scientist is, but to how many papers a scientist has written. Not to how smart, but to how many. Once a startup makes it to the final round of a pitch contest, there's no statistical difference between the returns of the finalists and the actual winners. It's called the equal odds rule. If you want to write a paper that people read, you publish. If you want to be successful at work, you go to work. And if you want to get good at jumping from one curve to the next, you jump. A simple metric, show up and keep showing up, especially when you're scared. And this is the other thing that the textbooks on disruption don't tell you. Disruption is, by definition, scary and lonely. Perhaps you've had the experience of announcing to the market an initiative you believe will be game-changing, only to discover that your stakeholders hate it. And then there's personal disruption, like when I left Wall Street. After the initial rush of excitement wore off, I felt a loss of identity. I could no longer call people and say, Whitney Johnson, Merrill Lynch. Now it was just Whitney Johnson. And some days, that wasn't enough. There have been other days where the PE, or puke to excitement ratio, is so uncomfortably high, I feel like I'm on a thrill ride to zero cash flow. It doesn't mean you shouldn't disrupt. It just means if it's scary and it's lonely, you're probably on the right track. In fact, if you have a feeling in the deepest part of yourself that you need to try something new and you don't, you'll die inside just a little. We even have a name for it. It's called the innovator's dilemma, because whether you innovate or not, you risk downward mobility, which is why our dreams are so important, why we have to bring our dreams to work. Because when we dream, we hunger for a better life. When we dream, we become problem solvers, letting nothing stand in our way. Dreaming is the engine of disruption, and the odds of success are 6 times higher, the revenue opportunity 20 times greater when you pursue a disruptive course. Do I dare? Do I dare? Do I dare disturb the universe? Most of us are pretty adept at doing the math around the future when things are linear. But neither business nor life is linear. And what the brain craves, even requires, is the delicious dopamine of the unpredictable. Saul Kaplan, the chief catalyst at the Business Innovation Factory, said, "My life has been about searching for the steep learning curve, swinging like Tarzan from one curve to the next, because that's where I do my best work. And when I do my best work, money, stature, and happiness have always followed." We give a lot of airtime to building and buying disruptive companies, and we should. But innovation ultimately begins on the inside. We start at the low end of the curve. We shift into gears that will allow us to scale. And when our learning peaks, we do what all great disruptors do. We walk straight into the innovator's dilemma and jump to a new curve. Because companies don't disrupt, people do. Thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. I get to ask Whitney probably 2 questions, and then we're going to get you outside, and you'll be signing books outside. So my first relates to generational differences, and I wonder what different lessons you see in generations in this disruption work. Is it harder for some, easier for others? You know, I think about the S-curves, the career S-curves, mm-hmm. of ourselves, of our parents, and then our millennial children.
Yeah.
So what differences do you
see? I think it's a great question. So what I would say, and I put the curve so you can look at it, but basically at the beginning of your career, it's going to be a lot easier to take the risk because you don't have very much to lose, right? You haven't had a job before. You don't have any stature. You don't make any money. So it's pretty easy to do. Where it gets really tough, generationally, is when you're in your 40s or 50s or even 60s, when you think about jumping to a new curve, it's a lot harder, right? Because you worry about the loss of stature and prestige and security, et cetera. So I do think that that aspect is harder. What I would say is for millennials, this whole idea of jumping curves is going to be a lot easier because most millennials, and you can, if you're a millennial in the room, you can disagree with me, but you're going to hold probably 14 jobs according to the statistics by the time you're 40 years old. So this whole notion of jumping curves becomes something that you've got to incorporate and know how to do. Whereas those of us who grew up in an era of the company man and the company woman, this isn't a skill set that we've necessarily developed. And so it's not that it's easier or harder, it's just that we don't have that skill set. So something that we have to learn how to do. And I hope that this book will help with that.
Yeah, in fact, I sent your book to my 24-year-old daughter,
yep,
who was in the middle of her first career disruption. But I told her to start with chapter 6 on failure.
Good.
I said, start there, then you're going to get hooked, and then read the whole book.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Because, you know, talk a little bit more maybe about that fear factor.
Yeah.
And how, even though they're comfortable with the idea of jumping to different curves, they still have to address.
Still fear. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would say, which is really interesting, is I actually had this interesting experience a couple weeks ago. So I was, I'd just given a presentation and it didn't go very well. I wasn't happy with it. And so, because I hadn't prepared very well. And I was talking to my husband, because my husband's my truth teller. And he said, well, you think that you're promotion focused, meaning you go after things because I talk about dreaming, like you're going to go after this and it's going to be so awesome and wonderful. Wow, wow, wow. He said, all you have to do is think about how am I going to feel if I bomb this thing, and then you'll prepare. And so the difference is promotion versus prevention focused. Most of us think we're promotion focused to going after the goal, but most of us are, probably 90% of us are prevention focused, meaning we say to ourselves, if I stand still, what are the consequences of standing still? And so we screw up our courage by realizing that it's worse for us if we stay where we are than if we jump, and that helps us have the courage to jump.
As I read your book, I was thinking this is not a business book, actually. I was thinking this is a book about life and how many places in my life I could apply, you know, this theory.
Good.
So thank you for giving me that. But I wonder if you can share something maybe unexpected that's come about as a result of you writing the book, maybe some unexpected application of the disruption theory that you hadn't thought about.
Yeah, so I would say one of the best things about writing a book is that when you put in print what you believe or think, then you're forced to kind of drink your own Kool-Aid. I think that's been a great thing. One of the unexpected things is that I realized that the chapter on entitlement, I had all sorts of really fascinating insight around that. And I'll tell you one specifically is that about a year ago, my doctor told me that I was pre-diabetic, and if I had been really a good patient and a grown-up, I would have said, yes, doctor, I understand, doctor, you know, I'll stop eating so much sugar, doctor. And instead, I threw a tantrum. I said, sugar is literally my only vice. I deserve a cookie. And then the doctor responded saying, surely you can find something that will make you happy besides a cookie. And I realized when this happened that I was being emotionally entitled. Like, I expected that my happiness mattered more than anything else. And then that actually applied very much to us in the workplace. Like, this whole attitude of, like, when a colleague gets a promotion or a colleague does well and has success, there's this feeling of, okay, I'm really happy for them, but I deserve that cookie. And how come I didn't get it? And so there's been a lot of really important insights for me around entitlement and realizing, like I said, when it comes in many guises, it comes in many guises.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I guess I would just say your book really resonated for me as somebody who left a Wall Street-related career and found a new job, you know, riding the wave of internet disruption,
yep,
impacting media and journalism. And so I've been in my job 11 years now. Some of my board members are here in the audience, so I want you to answer this very carefully. I'm going to ask this question very carefully. So how can you disrupt yourself if you want to stay in the same job,
right,
and have a positive impact you know, about the company you love, right?
Is his boss here?
Many of my bosses
are
here.
Yeah, okay. All right, Jane's your boss. She's here. Okay, so what I would say is that, as I mentioned on the Dave Blakely, right, he was at IDEO for 25 years. So what that means is that you, if you map against the 10,000-hour rule, you're going to get to the top of the curve, assuming you're working 40 hours a week, around 4 years in a role. And so if you want to refresh that, you don't necessarily need to change companies, but you do need to shake it up. So maybe, for example, you've been really focused on one element of the business, and maybe you've been doing fundraising. Like, that's been your whole sort of bread and butter. Maybe the way you shake it up is you trade places with someone else. They focus on fundraising, and you go deep into the operations. Like, what do you see with those fresh eyes? So there's ways that you can move that role inside of a company. And, in fact, there was a very interesting case study around this after I actually gave the speech not too long ago, and this fellow who's a CIO at JP Morgan, and they have seven different CIOs and the different business units. And their CEO just said, okay, I want each of you to move seats. So the CIO from one business went to a different, and they all traded places. And they said that the insight that came from this, of taking that expertise but applying it in a slightly different area, was astounding. And then the collaboration that took place after that was even higher, because they all had walked in each other's shoes.
Great. Thank you.
So,
I'm going to get disrupted here if we don't stop.
Okay. So, Jane's like, come on.
Jane and Rob are going to come up and get us on to the rest of the festival. And thank you, Whitney,
yes,
very much.
Yes, thank you.